Good evening and welcome to the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Jacob Grace. Tonight I'm going to be talking with Greg Galbraith, a Wisconsin dairy farmer. Greg began dairy farming after college and switched to grass-fed production, as he put it, to survive financially. After some initial reservations about going organic, he also converted his farm to an organic dairy. And although Greg retired a few years ago, a new generation of organic dairy farmers is keeping the farm in operation. Greg is now working to launch a podcast for the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship. But Greg is more than a former farmer and aspiring podcaster. He's also a writer, poet, painter, and musician. Greg says he used to listen to WORT in the barn at his first job after college, at the Hordes Dairyman Farm in Fort Atkinson. So we'll send a special shout out to any of you listening from your dairy barn tonight. This interview was originally used for a podcast I host called Perennial AF. Perennial AF is short for Perennial Agroforestry, in case you were wondering. And it's produced by an organization I work for called the Savannah Institute. You can find the Perennial AF podcast on their website, savannahinstitute.org, where you can also read about all the Perennial AF work the Savannah Institute does. All right, here's my guest, Greg Galbraith, talking to me remotely from Marathon County, Wisconsin.
Even this morning, when it was raining and it was like 40 something, I was... whenever that happens, I'm like, this is what I don't miss about having dairy companies. You know, when it goes into this season, actually today wasn't that bad, but you know, you get these nasty days on the borders of the seasons when it's not really frozen up yet. And anyway, it was great, but I don't miss those aspects of it.
Up first, we have Meredith M. on Facebook asks, my daughter and son-in-law are interested in taking over a 200-cow organic dairy near La Crosse, Wisconsin. They both worked on farms for several years, but this would be a huge investment for them, and I want to see them succeed. What are some of the biggest things for them to watch out for, and what are some of the things they could do to reduce their risk?
Yeah, this is a good one. And, you know, what came to my mind right away, I'm like, I'm not a very much of a business person. So as we go through this, a lot of these answers are do as I say, not as I do, you know. I mean, so I'll cover that with my answer. Like, from my own personal perspective, I was like, invest in as little as possible in things that rust, rot, and depreciate. That was the first thing that came across my mind. And that was a famous in grazing circles saying or quote, and I think it was in Stockman Grass Farmer. I think it was, it might've been Alan Nation's line, but I'm not 100%, but things that rust, rot, and depreciate, which means you're going to be prioritizing your investment in cattle. And that's one of my personal suggestions for reducing your risk. Better yet, on this answer, I talked to my former farm lender, and I talked to a Paul Dietman, who works for Compeer Financial, and is a good source for your question. He really deals directly with that. And one of the things that my ex-lender said right away was, you know, hopefully you have some familiarity with the area where this farm is. You know, that's not really evident in the question, and that's fine that it isn't, but it's important because him and I both talked about building positive relationships with the people around you on a farm is really helpful, you know. And I mean, it's funny, you know, everybody has different beliefs on how to farm and what's right and organic or conventional or row crops. And, you know, I'm big into all grass, but find a way to get to know each other, get along, and And that comes up in Paul's answer too. Or was it Brian? One of them was talking, I think it was Paul. You're gonna hear him talk about the ability to like share machinery and things. If you can keep those positive relationships, you can barter in many interesting ways. You know, hey, can you seed this field down? And in exchange, I'll do this for you or something like that. So, you know, keep, hopefully there's a familiarity. And if there isn't, hopefully you can, you know, work your way in and get to know the people and have an alliance versus a wall. And then Paul Dietman, who I talked about, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, Compeer Financial, he said, don't buy the land if you don't absolutely have to. And this goes into the Rust Rot depreciate thing. Land values and interest rates are both very high right now. The return on the land investment would be very low compared to the investment in the dairy herd. Taking on the debt load for land would add an enormous amount of overhead. He talked about entering into a solid long-term lease arrangement with the current owner. He says, by long-term, I mean 10 to 15 years. Negotiate a purchase option that you could exercise if cash flow supports it. So that's a little different from, I think, kind of Brian, my ex-lender, he was more like, try to do it on agree on a long land contract, a long-term land contract. And that is how we sold our farm. We sold just the buildings and surrounding acreage. It might have been the Home 40 outright to a young couple. The rest of the land they bought on a land contract. And then what that means is land contract is where you've got a legally binding agreement, and the people that buy it on a land contract pay you at an agreed increment. We get paid twice a month. So, you know, their answers are falling in line with what we did. Here's something Paul goes on to say. If you absolutely have to buy land, buy as little as possible, maybe just the buildings and a small acreage around the buildings. Lease the balance of the land. And I'll say it again, instead of that, we chose to form a land contract with the balance of the land. Oh, and important, utilize the USDA FSA beginning farmer down payment program for any real estate purchase. If you do purchase real estate, FSA beginning farmer loans, make sure you look that up. And I bet you anything you already know about it, the folks that are considering. Talks a little bit about the existing interest rates and things now under those programs, and they're just very advantageous to the buyer. Oh, and at the end, he says producing organic milk and utilizing managed grazing are both great risk mitigation strategies. You'll have less price volatility, and managed grazing slashes production costs. And of course, it was said to be an organic farm, so you'll have a grazing requirement. And I'm sure that they're familiar with grazing if they're considering this. He says it would be really difficult, nearly impossible, to purchase a 200-cow conventional dairy and make a go of it. Yeah, so if it was conventional with all the machinery and all that, Paul was saying it would be nearly impossible. The required capital investment and production costs are enormous burdens, difficult to bear, even with high production. So that was a great summary from both of those guys. And I hope you'll understand it and, you know, seek those people out if you want.
Sounds good. How did you, when you got started, were you always organic, always grazing, or how did you get going with that?
No, I went into it with, I'm going to get every drop of milk out of these cows I can. I got a dairy science degree and I know how. And there were so many reasons why it was rough. Uh-huh. Why it was never, those first few years were really difficult. And I was too busy fighting fires to fine-tune my feed ration. Mm-hmm. I was too busy trying to figure out how to get the silo unloader up high enough to fill the dang silo, because there was quirks with it. Okay, so any farmer that's listening to that is like, well, you just push the button and it goes up. But not if it's not set up right. That was just one of a million nightmares that led us to transitioning to grazing after a couple of years and being immediately happier with what we were doing and with all of the results. Yeah. So
okay.
It just kept going. And by the time we were done farming, our farm looked like practically a New Zealand style grass farm. I mean, mm-hmm. I always joked about no matter who I called to come to the farm for repairs or any situation, nobody ever didn't fly by and have to turn around and come back and go, is this really a dairy farm? Are you, you know,
wow.
they'd say like, where's the cows?
Uh-huh. It's all
a little parlor. You know, uh-huh. we did outwintering. We did all that. We did add a heifer barn and a feed strip, which was an excellent addition. But yeah, that was always one of my stories, is how people just zoom by and then they're like, are you Greg Galbraith? You know, is this really the place? Yeah, this is the place.
Wow.
So now I can't even remember the question, but.
Just kind of how you got started. So it sounds like you started grazing first to kind of avoid some of the quirks, and then so it was grazing first and then organic.
Yeah, and it was grazing first to survive.
Okay.
Financially.
Okay.
And then, truth be told, I was really an organic naysayer for a long time, early in my grazing years, because I wasn't organic and I wasn't super interested in going organic. And I was just jealous of the price they got, but it took quite a number of years, but we did transition and we sold our farm as organic. And we're able to do that. Actually, we had just completed all of the necessary steps right around the time when we sold the farm. So, and we were able to sell it to a young couple in the neighborhood that were already milking organic cows and grazing and wishing they had more land to graze. So,
okay.
Yeah, it worked out.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
You're listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine on WORT 89.9 FM. I'm your host, Jacob Grace. Tonight, I'm talking with retired dairy farmer Greg Galbraith. I got to know Greg through our work on a project called Grassland 2.0, which is working to imagine a new vision for Midwest agriculture. Grassland 2.0 believes that caring for ourselves means caring for the land, and that one of our best options for doing so is to have a lot more well-managed grazing, like Greg has been doing on his farm. You can get involved with Grassland 2.0 on their website, grasslandag.org. You can also hear my full interview with Greg on the Savannah Institute's podcast. Why don't we kind of wrap up with some of these story prompts here? So the first one is, let's see, what's the most surprising animal encounter you've had?
In the farmhouse, opening the door to the unheated back room where the gigantic chest freezer was, you know, that came with the house. And they basically built this room around it. No kidding, because they have such large freezers. Uh-huh. Anyway, yeah, you know, I got to get some ground beef. I open the door. I say unheated. This was in the fall. Like the heating was not really an element in this, but there was a giant pine stick at my feet in this kind of back room of my house. And you know, slam the door shut. No ground beef tonight. I mean, I ain't going back there for nothing.
Yeah.
And so that was one really surprising animal incident. And we had other pine snake, similar pine snake thing. There was a darn pine snake in the basement another time. And that's just no fun. I mean,
yeah,
you want it out of there. I want it. But I'm not going to grab it.
And you want someone else to get it out of there, not you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I have so many interesting cow ones.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, one that was kind of cool was there was an old silo foundation. So across the road from our farm in one of our pastures, mm-hmm. kind of a rocky, a sacrifice type area pasture, where we would throw the cows when it was convenient in the winter and whatnot. But, and I never had any problems. They didn't mess with it. They didn't inspect it. I guess I was being kind of not very bright there, but I mean, it took at least 25 or more years for there to be an incident. And that is, you know, it was like 8 feet down, you know, you go up, maybe not that deep, five or six feet, but it was down. You know, to mm-hmm. the silo floor, and yeah. a cow got down in there, and thankfully my son was our apprentice at the time, and you know, it took a lot of youthful strength and determination to get that sucker out of there. And she was a fresh heifer, you know, so she was milking her first lactation. And it was just a real trial, and I couldn't have even come close to doing it by myself. And, you know, she was like, oh, man, when I first saw her, she had a glassy-eyed stare. She had been laying there probably all day, and I didn't know it.
Uh-huh.
And it was just this glassy-eyed stare, just looking up. This dark, you may imagine that. So
yeah,
I felt really bad for her, but it ended well, you know. She uh-huh. came around.
how did you guys get her out?
Oh, I know the front end loader was involved, you know, chains, uh-huh. doing things. You know, I tell you, when it comes to those kind of incidences, and they happen with cows, uh-huh. you can't believe what you can do to a cow. Like, yep. this is going to sound awful, but
no, I
sometimes you have
say.
To do it. Like, put a chain, like, around its neck. Not yep. super tight, but
uh-huh.
lift it up. Move yep. it over. I mean, yeah. They can handle that. So,
right.
I could go on and on.
Yeah. no, I remember my dad saying, because we've had to pull cattle out of the mud by their yeah. head, and he said, you know, you can't put it around their middle, you can't put it around their legs or you'll break bones, but they can handle it if you just are really gentle. You can pull them out by their heads.
Oh man. And I know
their necks get all stretched out, but
right
come right out.
Well, I know that, you know, my son's strength came in very handy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, to get that you know, animal over that last ledge or whatever.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I, yeah, did we, I think I did, I fenced it off after that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So.
You didn't like turn it into a swimming pool.
Right. No, I didn't do that.
Yeah.
But boy, you know, I could write a book of interesting stories like that, I think.
Yeah. Okay. The next one is, well, we are kind of getting into this. What's your funniest farm fail or something going wrong on the farm?
Well, I just wrote about this fairly recently for AgriView. We had a New Zealand style swing parlor. So if anybody wants to look that up, well, they won't have to. I'll tell you what it is. It's a very bare bones milking parlor designed to milk cows fast. Not a lot of fooling around. And they're very open. Okay. Ours was particularly wide open, other than the steel with rails, you know, that kept cows from kicking you and stuff. And you milk the cows through their rear legs, 12 on one side, 12 on another. So you quick put 12 units over there, swing the units over to that side. Those cows would go out, the side would fill, hopefully all my gesticulations are just making this so easy for you to understand.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
This.
Yep.
Anyway, so you could get manure on you in this way. I mean, you're mm-hmm. milking cows. You better be aware of what's up above that udder.
Yeah.
And I
look
was
up to see what's coming down.
Yeah. And so the fails, you know, Wendy got more right on the head incidences, maybe two real glaring, you know, wow situations where you either take your clothes off or, you know, you got to do something.
Uh-huh.
My little story that I ended my AgriView thing was, I did not ever get the full, you know, right all over me. But mm-hmm. one time, you know, I had these, you know what a muck boot is? So I had, it was open at the bottom, and, you know, a cow managed to produce a geyser of processed grass with a lot of bacterial action and a lot of heat.
Ooh.
And it went right into my top of my boot. I was milking alone, and I had no choice but to just gut it out and uh-huh. walk around. And I described it as, I used the words from a famous children's book, which it's about a piggy in a puddle. Uh-huh. And it goes, it was ishy, it was squishy, it was also ushy, squishy, you know, something like that. Uh-huh. That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
So that was my farm fail, although, boy, we go on.
Yeah.
Suppose me. Well, I think it was supposed to be funny, right? This was supposed to be
a light. Yeah, we wanted it to be like, funny.
Not like the time I almost lost the farm with some, you know, business decision.
Yeah, no.
Like buying a $14,000 Martin guitar instead of a no-till drill, you know.
Right. All right. On to the last one here. This is kind of intentionally open-ended, but any good stories from past generations?
Yeah, and it really lets me kind of expound on something. One of my phases of creativity, which I'd like to get back into, was writing epigrams. And I did it with a friend, a very good writer, accomplished writer. And we were exchanging epigrams all the time. And an epigram, to put it simply, it's what? A short, I'll say clever, perceptive observation. Couple of sentences.
Mm-hmm.
We were exchanging epigrams for, I'm going to say, at least 1 or 2 years. And then mm-hmm. we finally put together a show with it. You know, we went to we did poetry readings where we were the feature and we stood up there and we exchanged these epigrams. Mm-hmm. And this is getting to a family story. His favorite epigram of mine, and I might not get it perfect, was something like, they say, one is not truly dead until nobody remembers them. Next sentence. It's not easy being responsible for the lives of so many old farmers.
Mm.
So that's almost making me emotional to say. So here's the story. And so by letting me tell this story, I totally bring these guys back to life. So now I'm off the hook with these two guys, you know, for maybe a couple of years. Who knows?
But right.
My grandfather and his brother had small dairy farms in the neighborhood that I had my farm. That's what drew me there. You know, they had 30 cow Guernsey herds, little tiny barns, little milk houses separate from the barn, you know, that whole scene from the 50s. Mm-hmm. And they would help each other a lot. And they were making hay and they were putting it on the elevators and it was going up into the hay mow. So my grandfather was at the bottom putting the hay on the thing, the elevator. My grandfather's brother was up top stacking the hay. He hooked his finger on the elevator and took off half of his little finger. He was able to catch it, keep it, and he, I don't know how he pulled all this off, and I may have some details wrong here, but I know that this part is totally true. And this doesn't match the scenario with my grandpa doing the unloading. I think my grandpa was back home on his own place.
Okay.
With his own farm when they were making hay. Mm-hmm. So my grandfather's brother put the finger in a box, gave it to my uncle, you know, his nephew.
Mm.
Here, take this to George. So he takes it on his bike. He goes scooting across the road, gives it to my grandfather. And my grandfather's like, oh, got to take Tony to the emergency room. You know. So I always love that story. And I have so many ancestral stories that, I mean, again, it's another book, you know, possibility. Because, and I've said it a million times, I mean, that's what drew me to farming. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and naively wanting that simple life that I observed in them for just a bit while I was, you know, like 5 or 6 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Before they retired from farming, lived on their farms, but no longer were active. But no, the point is that I did naively really want that simplistic ness to my life. And by then, you know, farming was a little more complicated and more competitive. And so it wasn't as simple as I thought it would be. But I can say, like my grandfather always said, after he would talk about all of his trials, including riding the rails to Beardsley, Minnesota, to help harvest wheat, you know, literally jumping on a boxcar and getting there with no money, 50 cents he said he had for a bologna sandwich. So he was a big storyteller. Oh, but at the end, after all of his trials that he would describe to me, he would say, you know, he wouldn't have had it any other way. So I'm there. I'm kind of there. That's kind of how I feel.
That's great. That's
I'm lucky. Although the whole farming thing turned into a whole new avenue for me. And the fact that I'm sitting here talking to you is part of that. And I never would have expected it. So it's all good.
Yeah.
And I get to bring those guys back now.
That's right.
Go on to the next farmer that's almost.
Yep. Maybe that'll be the next book.
Right. Right. Yeah. Cool.
All right. Well, unless you have anything you want to add, I think we made it through the questions here. And thanks so much, Greg. This was everything I was hoping it would be. You have a lot of great stories and a lot of great experience. So thanks for being a part of this.
I appreciate it.
That was writer and retired dairy farmer Greg Galbraith talking with me about his memories from the farm. You can learn more about Greg and read some of his work at his blog, poeticfarmer.com. You can also hear my full interview with Greg on the Savannah Institute's podcast. You've been listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine. I'm your host, Jacob Grace. Thanks for listening. Facing beta, blasting through the night.